So a couple of weeks ago, we went through the whole book of Revelation, and so if you missed that class, well, I'm sorry. We've already discussed what Revelation is about. The point of that class was really to talk about what's the story? What's going on? What's the imagery that is being used in the book of Revelation? And something that I encouraged you to do in the 2 weeks since that class, and if you've not done it, I want to encourage you to do it again. I want you to read through the book of Revelation in as short a time period as you can. I know it's a fairly lengthy read, but if you can read it in one sitting or two sittings, that's something that's very, very beneficial to you. And I'll even help you out with that. If you want to break it up into two sittings, read Revelation 1 through 11, which is kind of a section, and then 12 through the end of the book, which is another kind of section, even though it's really all kind of flows together. And I think if we sit down and just go through the book in that way, as I suggested a couple of weeks ago, we get the big picture. We get the big picture of the images that are being used, the way that God is unfolding this persecution that's coming upon these Christians, and then the judgment that's going to come from God and vindicate His people, where He's going to have victory over Satan and his armies and those who are persecuting those who are in Christ. You know, we have all sorts of issues with the book of Revelation, one of which, as I talked about last time, is a lot of times we talk about what all this means before we even get the image of what it is. But may I suggest that another issue we have with the book of Revelation is, we read through our Bible and we read through our New Testament. We go through the Gospels, we go through Acts, we go through the Epistles, and then we come to the book of Revelation and we expect to read it in exactly the same way that we read those other books. If you have your handout, on this side it says five questions that we need to answer regarding the book of Revelation. And we're going to try and go through those five questions this evening. And the first question is, what kind of book is this? Now you say, well, it's in the Bible, why does that matter? May I suggest that it makes a big difference in what we should expect as we're reading through this book. So, in my office, I have a number of different kinds of books, and so I just grabbed a few. This is a history magazine. What would I expect to find if I open up this book? I'm asking. This is obvious, but I'm asking. History, right? And specifically, we know a magazine like this. You've opened a magazine like this before. How's it going to kind of be laid out? You probably know. All right, short articles about a number of different things. And in fact, the cover tells us some of those things that are going to be in here. So if I hand this to you, you already have an idea of what you're going to kind of find inside this book, right? Let me pick another one. Here's this book called The Crusader. It's a biography about Ronald Reagan. Who in here has read this book? Anybody? Nobody. That's what I was hoping. It's a pretty good book. But if you open this book you've never read, you already have an idea of kind of what's going to be found in this book, right? What's going to be in this book? What's it going to be about? Ronald Reagan. Well, how did you know that? Because his picture's on it. That's right. Because it's a biography, right? And a biography is always a story about a person. And that person and what that person was doing. So before you even open this book, you have a pretty good idea of what's going to be found in it, right? Let me use another example. Okay, this is a biblical religious book. This is a commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. So if you open up this book, how's it going to be laid out? What do you expect to find in this book, this commentary? Verse by verse, it goes through and it's laid out. Here's the verse. Here's what this says in the Gospel of Matthew. And then under that, you'll find commentary, right? This is what this person believes that that means. He is trying to give his commentary, his explanation of what that is. So before you even open up this book, you have a pretty good idea of what's going to be contained in it, or at the very least, how it's going to be laid out and how you would go about reading that book. And I've got other examples here. I've got a novel. I've got a book of poetry. I've got a book that involves plays. And for all of those things, if I tell you it's a book of poetry, you have an idea of what it's going to be. If I tell you it has plays in it, you have an idea of how it's going to be laid out. If I tell you it's a novel, you have an idea of what's going to be contained in it. And even if I gave you the genre of that novel, that it's fantasy or sci-fi or real crime or whatever the case might be. Well, let's apply that same concept to the New Testament. The Gospels and the Book of Acts. You open those up, what kinds of books are those? Books of what? History. Okay, so what would we expect to find? And what do we find in the Gospels and in Acts? Historical accounts. Records of what happened, right? Some of it is very chronological. Some of it's a little bit out of order. But we have these stories of this is what happened, this is what was said, and so on and so forth. Then we get to what we call the epistles, which is just another word for what? Letters. That's exactly right. So we open up the epistles, and what do we expect to find, and what do we find? Letters, right? But what's contained? They all start out basically the same way. What is it? Greetings. This is from whom? This is to whom? And then instructions, right? I'm writing you for this purpose with these issues that are going on. This is the reason why I'm writing, and these are the things that I'm addressing. Usually of a doctrinal nature, because obviously these are biblical epistles in regard to the people to whom it's written, whether it's the church in Corinth or Thessalonica or to a group of people like the Hebrews. And so we have a very good idea of what basically to expect when we open up any of those books. Then we get to the book of Revelation. And it's not a whole lot like anything that we've read up to this point in the New Testament. And so the book of Revelation, what should we expect? What kind of book is this? Well, the book of Revelation is a good example of what is called apocalyptic literature. And you don't have to remember that. That's just a Greek word that means a hidden meaning, a revealing, an uncovering. It's the idea that something that wasn't seen before now is seen. It's revealed for others to see. A special insight, a revealing of something is involved here. And specifically with apocalyptic literature, it uses signs and symbols in order to accomplish that. Let's read verse 1, if you would with me, please, of Revelation chapter 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, things which must shortly take place, and he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John. Now, I was having a conversation with somebody about this study and how they were excited about it. And they said, I don't know a whole lot about the book of Revelation, but I know verse 1, that it's signs and symbols because he signified it. He signified it. And that's exactly right. That word indicates here that these are symbols, that these are signs that are used that aren't intended to be taken literally. But these are things that are supposed to communicate something through these signs and symbols. On the back side of your handout, we're not going to go through all of this. Things like numbers are important in the book of Revelation. So this is for your reference. We're going to go through some of these things as we go through the book, so I won't go through all of them now. But we have good numbers and bad numbers as they're used throughout the entire Bible, as they're used in extra-biblical Jewish literature. And so we see that these numbers have meaning a lot of time, deeper symbolic meaning. And knowing what all of these numbers mean isn't going to change our understanding of the Bible or salvation or anything like that, but it can give us deeper understanding, deeper insight into the images that are being used by John, or more specifically, that are being revealed to John by Jesus Christ. And so, on your own time, you can go through those and see what a number of these numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 10, 12, 40, 3.5, 6, those are the ones that I've listed, what those things mean. Do we have other examples in the Bible of this kind of literature, like the book of Revelation? Yes, we do. Not in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament. What books? Daniel? What else? Ezekiel? Very good. Zechariah? Those are the big three. Some people would argue that there are some other places maybe that have this kind of feel to it in the Old Testament. And then in the New Testament, people usually cite one chapter as being this kind of literature. Some people put it into two, but Matthew 24 and maybe Matthew 25, depending on how you look at it. I think those are more like parables from my judgment. And so we do see other examples of this in the Bible. And the interesting thing about the book of Revelation is what we see are images that are very, very similar, that draw upon those familiar themes that we see in Daniel and Ezekiel and Zechariah. And understanding and studying those books would give us even more insight into what exactly is going on here. But maybe you're saying to yourself, this sounds like a lot of preacher talk. What exactly does that mean? Apocalyptic literature, what would I expect? I have certain expectations for a biography. I have certain expectations for a book of poetry. So what should my expectations be for a book that is this genre of literature? Well, there on your handout, if you go down to the bottom, 10 features of apocalyptic literature. People express this in different ways. I actually borrowed this list from David McClister because I think this is a very complete list. You could probably combine some of these if you really wanted to, but I think this covers what we should expect to find and what we do find in the book of Revelation. So let's just go through these together, and then we'll cover the rest of our five questions. Number one, this kind of literature was only produced in times of perceived crisis and conflict, only when there was a serious problem that's going on. And it's to provide help for people to cope with those times of troubles. If it's a period in history when there's a chicken in every pot and everybody's worshiping God and all things are good, you wouldn't expect this kind of literature. But we gave some examples, right? Daniel and Ezekiel, what was the big crisis during those times? The captivity, the Babylonian captivity. Was that a crisis? You better believe it. Is God going to remember His people? Most of us have been killed. The rest of us brought into slavery. There's a few left over there that aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. What is God going to do with His people? It's a crisis. And so this was written so that those people might understand and see that, yes, God is going to save His people and redeem His people. Zechariah was written during a time of crisis as well. Maybe this one is more spiritual in nature, but what was the crisis for Zechariah? Okay, the temple needs to be rebuilt. There's pressure on all sides from these people because the remnant that is back in Israel, they're not serving God like they're supposed to. And Haggai, he comes along and his reads like an epistle, right? Hey, you've built your own houses, but you hadn't built the house of God. You need to stop it and get to work and build. And it's like super short, right? And then Zechariah comes along with all of these chapters and chapters with all of these visions and imagery and symbols and so forth. And there's lampstands and there's olive trees and all of these things going on. But he's got the same message, except his is expressed in this kind of literature. What you're doing right now is a crisis. And what you have to do is return to God so that ultimately He might save you. So there's a crisis going on, and we'll talk about, well, what's the crisis in Revelation? But number two, it presents the information in the form of a story, an account, a narrative, a vision, however you want to put that. The details of the story are not necessarily historical events that are to come. It's not intended to be some chronological view of the future, though sometimes that's the case. In some ways, it's more similar to the parables of Jesus than anything else besides the other apocalyptic books. The stories that Jesus told, those parables, were they intended to be real events? Well, they could have been, right? But Jesus wasn't saying, this is going to happen in the future. Instead, what Jesus is doing, he's trying to communicate something else. What was it that he was trying to communicate with his parables? A principle, right? This is what the kingdom of heaven is like. It's not when these things are going to happen in the future, but the nature of God's kingdom. And so we see certainly the nature of God's deliverance for these people in the book of Revelation. And we get so concerned with when is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? But I'm not sure that that's his point at all. Number three, the story or vision uses fantastic illustrations and symbolism and drama to make its point. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation 12 and verse 1. Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head was a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. And his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. That's weird, isn't it? Well, why does he express it this way? Because it's memorable. But also, for emphasis, the author is trying to make a point in the most dramatic way possible. And I think maybe we understand that. What makes the greatest impression on you? What is easier to remember, maybe? Our society is often pressuring us to do things that we should not do as Christians. Or, we as Christians are at war, and we're at war with a beast that looks like this coming up out of the sea. Which one has more emphasis placed upon it, more emphatic? I think we know. Or what about this? You know, the Roman government has overstepped its bounds that God has given it. Well, that's true. That's the message. But there's a prostitute who rides on a red dragon that has 10 horns, and she has a cup in her hand that is filled with her harlotries, and she has become drunk with the blood of the saints. Which one makes the bigger impression? Which one is more memorable? And which one, as you stand before an official who says you need to curse Christ and worship these idols, or we're going to burn you at the stake, we're going to crucify you, which one would you hold on to? Well, you know what? The Roman government has really overstepped its bounds here. Or I am at war with this harlot who rides on this red dragon, and she is going to be drunk with my blood because I'm going to be martyred for the cause of Christ. But I know that there is one who's coming on a white horse, King of kings and Lord of lords, and he will not make my blood be in vain. I will be victorious whether they take my life or not. You tell me which one makes a greater impression. You tell me which one you would hold on to in that moment of choice. You know, I think probably part of the reason why we have a hard time identifying with the images that are used in Daniel or Ezekiel or Zechariah or even Revelation is because we've never been through a crisis like that. But it doesn't mean that we won't. It doesn't mean that there's not a day coming where we may have to. And in those times, we too could look to the book of Revelation and remember that the Lord is going to win no matter what. No matter what powers of hell and Satan come against me, if I am on the Lord's side, I'm going to win too. And yes, I might have to resist even to the point of blood, even to the point of death. But I know that God is going to win in the end. Remember, this is not just talking about somebody having a bad day. You know, a few people are talking bad about you. You don't write the book of Revelation because of that. No, it's a serious crisis where captivity and destruction and death and martyrdom are on the line. All right, thoughts or comments there? All right, you missed your opportunity. Number four. The symbolic story reveals truths or outcomes that would be otherwise unknown. It reveals things that are not obvious, that we couldn't see by human means. I mean, if as I believe this is talking about the Roman Empire, who could have predicted the fall of the Roman Empire, right? Especially during the first century. That is just not something that we could see or perceive by human means. And so it's drawing back the curtain to give us the reality, yes, of things that might happen, but also the spiritual reality, or at least an image of what that spiritual reality might be like. Let me maybe explain it this way. The epistles are kind of like, if I ask the question, how does a car work? And you said, well, you turn the key, and then you push this little lever on the floor, and it goes. Well, is that true? Is that how a car works? Well, in a sense, yes, right? But then the book of Revelation is like you get out and you hit that little lever and it pops a little bit and you pop open the trunk and you look in there and you say, wow, there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. It's not just pushing that little lever. There's a lot happening here. And that's what the book of Revelation does for us. There are spiritual realities behind these physical things that we see all around us. It involves a message from a heavenly messenger and visions or dreams that a human receives and then writes down. And the message is often interpreted by that heavenly messenger, and we see that a number of places in the book of Revelation. Number five, the revelation presents a view of the heavenly realm, its realities and activities. It's a big picture view, the view behind the scenes that we're talking about here. So things that we might not have known, and then things behind the scenes. Number six, the view of the heavenly realm provides a perspective on the present sufferings, the crisis and conflict. It's not just saying, okay, isn't this cool? We can see behind the scenes, but it gives us insight into what is happening. I think a great example of this is the book of Job, right? How beneficial would it have been? Now, God in His wisdom, I think for our sakes, did not reveal to Job everything that was happening. But for us, it was revealed, right? What was going on behind the scenes that Job knew nothing about? A conflict between Satan and God. And Satan comes and he talks bad about God's servant. He's only serving you because of what you're doing for him and all these sorts of things. Job doesn't know anything about that. But we, as people who still suffer today, we can see behind the scenes and say, okay, Satan is ultimately behind this. And that's what the book of Revelation does as well. It shows us behind the scenes, but it speaks to what's going on in our lives. It provides additional information so that we can deal with our earthly situation, so that we can endure it. Number seven. The message is one of coming judgment on the enemies of God and vindication of His people. God says, essentially, you don't worry about the ultimate outcome. I'm going to beat these people down so bad that they will never come back again. And you say, ooh, are we supposed to think like that? We're not. But God is the ultimate judge who knows the hearts of all men. He is the one who is the righteous judge. And it's interesting to me that there are those who cry out when God's wrath is poured forth, reminding us that God is that righteous judge. And you see this image of there being blood up to the horses' bridles in 200 miles in every direction? That's drastic, isn't it? That is total domination. And there is a coming time where things are going to be set right by God. And the judge of all things is going to make sure that things are right in the end. This drastic action by God takes the old existing order of things that has become corrupted and hostile to God and to His people, and all those wrongs are set right. Wickedness is judged, righteousness is manifested, and something new is brought forth from all of that. We see that lots and lots of times in the Bible. You think about the flood. Was that drastic? Can I hear your head rattle on that one? Pretty much. There's eight people left, right? And yet when they walk out of that ark, there's a rainbow in the sky and God's covenant, and things have been made new, right? You think about Sodom and Gomorrah on a smaller scale. Was that drastic by God? Yeah. I mean, things are still dead there. Things still don't grow there, in all likelihood, where those cities took place. We think about the judgment that he had upon Babylon or Nineveh or all of those cities, and we know from history how they were totally destroyed. God's people were vindicated then, and they will be vindicated now. Number eight. The message is also that the kingdom of God will overcome all enemies and rival kingdoms and will endure. Remember in that image of that great statue in Daniel, there's a stone that comes. And what happens with the stone? Remind me. It destroys, pulverizes that statue. And then from that, this great mountain comes forth. Right? And we are reminded that God's kingdom is the only kingdom that endures. Now, if you are somebody who is looking at this beast of the Roman Empire, a kingdom like has never been seen on earth before, don't you imagine to yourself, what does God's little kingdom have against this kingdom? Maybe that's a temptation. And yet, for these people, they needed to be reminded that God's kingdom was the one that was going to endure. Number nine, the message gives hope in a situation of perceived silence and inactivity by God. We think to ourselves, where is God? Why isn't He acting on this occasion? And there is a message that comes from God saying, no, I am still at work. Be ready. Because ultimately, I am going to work and my work is going to be final. And then finally, number 10, it is not just this message with all of these images and symbols. There is included in the message moral exhortation and warning to God's people. I think as we study through Revelation, that's why we're so comfortable with Revelation chapters 2 and 3, because that's the moral exhortation. That's what we're more used to, right? The churches are doing bad in this way, they're doing well in this way, and this is what they need to do next. We can kind of follow that progression, and that makes sense to us. Well, that's something that we would expect to see in a book like this. But may I suggest that even after we get past chapters 2 and 3, there are still applications to be made to us in our lives and the way we are supposed to be living. This book calls for endurance. It calls for us to remain faithful. It calls for us as the righteous not to be corrupted by the wicked and not to participate in the evil that is all around us that is ultimately going to be judged by God. That's the kind of book that we're about to read. And just like you know what a biography is, what a book of poetry is, when we go into this book, that is what we should expect to find. All right, thoughts or comments there? I know what you're thinking. Well, when are we going to get to the dating of the book, right? That's what we've been thinking for three classes. Well, not yet. I've got one more question to answer before we get there. To whom was it written? Well, this is an easy one. You can tell me. To Christians specifically, we're told. What Christians? The seven churches of Asia. So these seven churches that are specifically there in Asia Minor, he calls them all by name and he writes to each one of them specifically. So we know to whom it was written. Now, why is that important? Would it make much sense for me to write a letter to Brent Bonnell and say, let me tell you about all of the things that are really important for Jesse Cisco to know? Does that make a lot of sense? Well, maybe if I was wanting Brent to go and tell Jesse. But even more, if I write a letter to Brent Bonnell and I say, here are all the things that Luke Douthat needs to know. Do you know who Luke Douthat is? That's a friend of mine from Memphis. That makes no sense whatsoever, right? So if I'm writing a letter to Brent Bonnell, what do you think that letter is going to include? Some things that apply to Brent Bonnell, right? And so if this vision and these letters are ultimately written to the seven churches of Asia, then it should probably include things that are applicable to whom? The seven churches of Asia. that we find listed here. Okay, so that brings us to what is our time frame here? Well, here's what we know. It seems to be talking about events that will happen soon, that will shortly take place. Verse 1, as we read, things which must shortly take place. Drop down to verse 3. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is what? Near. Let's go to the last of the book, Revelation 22. And verse 6. Then he said to me, these words are faithful and true. And the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants the things which must, what? Shortly take place. And then down even in verse 10. And he said to me, do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. These are things which must shortly take place, which are going to happen soon. To give you some context, okay, what is shortly? What is at hand? What is near? What is soon? Well, in Daniel 8 and verse 26, it talks about things that are many days in the future, and that's talking about maybe 400 or 500 years in the future. And so whatever near is or soon is, we would assume that it would be something less than 500 years if that's far in the future. Number two, going back to what we said just a moment ago, when we think about in what time frame this was written, there are so many who take the book of Revelation and they run to the end of time for all of it. What is the problem, based on what we said just a moment ago, what is the problem with making all of this about the end of time? That is not something that is particularly helpful to the seven churches of Asia. And it leaves Revelation altogether out of relation to the needs of the churches to which it is addressed. And so it seems that the book cannot be talking, at least primarily, about the end of time. These are things that are shortly going to take place pertaining to these churches. So, number three on this list, for what reason was it written? Persecution. That's very clear. Nobody would argue with that. There's persecution that is taking place for these Christians. In the first century, my mother would get on to me, persecuted Christians. What people persecuted Christians? Jews did, Romans did, and in a limited sense, other Christians did. But we'll just keep it to those two. The Jews did, and the Gentiles did, the Romans did. So who is it that is ultimately persecuting these Christians? If it's the Jews, then the symbolism of the book refers to Judaism, the destruction of Jerusalem. Some would add the Judaizing teachers to this, those converts to Christianity who say that the Gentiles have to live as the Jews, and that's where the persecution is coming from. If it's the Gentiles, the Romans, then obviously the symbolism of the book refers to the elements of Roman paganism and specifically emperor worship that was taking place during the first century. Now, it's become in vogue among scholars today to say, well, that emperor worship thing was really overblown. That's not something that we would see a lot of. That sounds good when people are trying to support their position, but the fact of the matter is that's really not the case. Emperor worship goes all the way back to Augustus. Here in Caesarea Philippi, this is where Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church. That's a vivid image behind him, this giant rock, right? But it's interesting there. Here is what that would have looked like in the first century. And right over here on the left, you see it's number one on the legend, the Temple of Augustus. Who was Augustus? A Roman emperor, right? The first one who was worshipped as a god that we know through archaeology. And this is going back all the way to the time of Jesus. Now, in defense, Augustus wasn't worshipped in this way until after his death. And for most of the Roman emperors, that's the way they viewed it. Okay, I'm an emperor. I'm at the very top of the food chain. When I die, I graduate up into being a god, and then people worship me. And then some guys came along and decided, you know what? Why do I have to wait until after I die to be worshipped like a god? Why can't I be worshipped like a god now? And specifically, at the end of the first century, Domitian had that very concept of the way he wanted people to worship him. And so widespread throughout the Roman Empire, worship of the emperor during the first century became a big issue. Now, why would that have been a problem for Christians? Obviously. I can't worship anybody before God. And so if this is starting to be enforced as something you have to do, then just like Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, these Christians too would have to suffer for their faith. I've tipped my hand a little bit about which position I take on that. I believe this is talking about that Roman persecution. But based on those two ideas, there are two dates given for the book. The early date is the early to mid-60s A.D. before the destruction of Jerusalem. That could be because of Jewish persecution, or some people believe Roman persecution under Nero. We remember the burning of Rome in the mid-60s. And Nero's persecution was brutal, it was intense, but it was also confined to Rome and the surrounding area. I think much more likely that we'll take the late date in our study. Now, as we go through, I'm going to try and give you some evidence for the other date as it appears, as it is viable. Especially the first 11 chapters, you see some things that sound like Jerusalem, and we'll discuss that. The internal evidence is there. But I think the internal evidence, especially in chapters 12 and following, is much stronger for the late date. And also the external evidence of what people early on in Christianity believe that John was talking about is for that late date as well. Both bells have rung. Let me just, before that last bell rings, what are we supposed to get out of it? Take this with you tonight. This book is supposed to give God's people the proper perspective and hope to world events. All these things are happening. What should be our perspective and our hope? Number two, it's supposed to give encouragement to God's people. The Lord is going to win. And if we are on His side, we're going to win too. And that's what we see, number three. So often in matters of religion, in matters of morality, in matters of war, everybody's asking, is God on my side? May I suggest that that's the backwards question? The question is not, is God on my side? The question is, am I on God's side? Because the Lord is going to win. And if I'm on His side, if I'm doing what He would have me to do, then I'm going to win too. All right, we'll get into the text of Revelation next week. Thank you for your good attention.